Today's guest tells us that the attachment system, like the reproductive system, is a fundamental part of what it means to be human. It's the way nature engineered our survival. We'll find out more in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk. I am pleased to introduce you to today's guest, Peter Lovingheim. Peter is an author and journalist whose articles and essays have appeared in many, many places, including the New York Times, Parade Magazine, The Washington Post, you name it. Peter also occasionally teaches nonfiction writing at the Writer Center, which is in Bethesda, Maryland. Peter Lovingheim, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Peter, you actually come to your study and your book about attachment. How? You're not a clinician, so how did you come to this interest?
Right. I'm not a psychologist. I'm a writer and journalist. It's a personal story. I suppose I can share it, but I was just out of a 20-year marriage and was starting to date again. I was in a relationship that was like an emotional roller coaster, lots of ups and downs, breakups and makeups, and I was puzzled by that. It's not something I had experienced before. And then when visiting my daughter at college, I was leafing through her psych textbook, and I came across this thing called attachment theory, which I'd never heard of. But in one section of the text, the authors described what can happen when people with two different attachment styles, and I didn't know what that meant at the time, try to become a couple. And it said that they can experience lots of ups and downs and breakups and makeups and have a very turbulent relationship. It went on to describe to a T what I'd been experiencing. I was intrigued, and I just wanted to learn more. That's how this all started.
And learn more you did.
I spent 7 years researching this area of attachment science, talking to experts in the field, doing a lot of literature research, and then going out and meeting people who illustrated the various topics that I wanted to discuss in my book.
So let's start with the main forms of attachment that you learned about. Let's talk about secure attachment. What did you learn that means, and what does it look like in a relationship?
Well, a secure attachment is really what we all want to give our children, if possible. People who come out of early childhood with attachment security generally are able to trust others, be comfortable with intimacy. They, when faced with setbacks in life, such as illness, injury, or loss of a loved one, they tend to have lots of resilience. And they get really what I think of as the big prize. They are best able to enjoy long, stable, loving relationships. That's secure attachment.
And what about avoidant attachment? What's that look like?
Avoidant attachment, this happens when an infant child, maybe between birth and age 2 or 3, really pretty consistently fails to receive sensitive, responsive care from whoever the primary caregiver is. And as an adult, a person with an avoidant attachment often finds it difficult to trust others, is not comfortable with intimacy. In fact, somebody like that often thinks, like, what's the big deal about relationships? I'm fine on my own. I want to be independent and self-reliant. So these people as adults tend to have difficulty forming and maintaining close, loving relationships.
And anxious attachment.
anxious attachment, this develops, again, in earliest childhood, where the infant or young child sometimes receives sensitive, responsive care and sometimes does not. It's inconsistent. And adults who grow up with this type of attachment, they tend to crave relationships. They just want intimacy, but at the same time, they tend not to trust it. And their relationships often have a kind of push-pull quality. They are constantly seeking reassurance from their relationship partners. People might describe them as clingy sometimes or needy, but they have trouble trusting that their relationship partners will be there for them.
So in the relationship that you just described that you were in at one point, based on your research, what would you say was the likely attachment style for your then partner and for yourself, if you feel comfortable sharing that?
Yeah, sure. Well, what I learned a long way of my research is that partner and I fell into what's sometimes called the anxious avoidant trap. This is really the worst combination of attachment styles for people pairing off as partners. I think my partner probably had an avoidant attachment style, and at that time, well, I would say that generally my attachment style tends towards the anxious, so that when people try to form this type of pair, it becomes a vicious cycle where the anxious person is often looking for more reassurance, looking for more intimacy. This pushes away the avoidant partner, and which only then reinforces the anxious partner's sort of expectation of not having the type of emotional security they're looking for. And by the way, all these types of pairings can work out. It's just that people with these insecure attachment types just have a greater challenge. And one way to deal with it, if you happen to be in such a relationship, is simply to understand first what your own attachment style is. And in my book, I offer a quiz you can take. It's got 36 questions. It takes about 5 minutes, and it'll give you a pretty good understanding of your own attachment style. But the first thing is you learn your own attachment style. Then you try to understand what your partner's is, and then you talk about it based on your knowledge of attachment. And people can generally work around the problem areas if they both understand those things.
So the good news about learning about attachment is, aside from the fact that every human being has an attachment style, is that when you learn what yours is, then you can perhaps navigate in a different way your own relationship choices and be able to tolerate the differences between you and your relationship choice. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what I would want is for people to understand that they have an attachment style and then learn what it is and then see it as a new lens through which to view all the relationships in their lives. And certainly we are talking about intimate romantic relationships, but really all relationships. So our attachment system influences how we relate to people, you know, in all walks of life, family members, with aging parents, with our closest friends, with colleagues at work, even with teammates on a sports team or relations between a player and a coach. There's interesting research showing that our attachment style even affects the way we relate to political leaders and what our political leanings are as voters. So it's something that affects us in all walks of life from, you know, as they say, from cradle to grave.
You know, what's interesting is that there are some folks who, even hearing the word attachment, sort of sets their teeth on edge. Because it just seems like it's such a potentially overwhelming, weak way of thinking about relationships. So it's...
Yes. I mean, I would totally disagree with people who think that way, but I understand where it comes from. We sort of have a myth in our culture that I think the highest form of maturity is to be entirely self-reliant and independent, but I don't believe that's how human beings are constructed. I think from birth, we are designed to connect with others, and when we do, and when it's successful connection, that's where we find our greatest joy in life. And so I wish we could get away from thinking that becoming attached to another person is a bad thing. In fact, it's the best thing. Maybe if we use a term like interdependent, that sounds better, because that's really what we're aiming for, to be interdependent with another person. Or many other people, usually results in the greatest pleasures in life.
As you were researching the attachment effect, you learned about a little guy by the name of Isaiah who was participating in the strange test. So I have two questions for you. Tell us about Isaiah and what is the strange test?
Okay, let me take the second question first. The strange situation test is a way that attachment style is measured in young children. And it was kind of a brilliant creation of a psychologist named Mary Ainsworth, who started out as a research assistant to John Bowlby, who developed attachment theory. But Mary Ainsworth developed this test as a way of measuring attachment style in children up to about age two. So in my book, I have a chapter about how this test works, what it looks like. The boy Isaiah, who you mentioned, is somebody who I saw at a visitation center run by the local government, where children who are in foster care are brought once a week to reunite with their birth parents. And what I saw Isaiah illustrate was the really worst form of attachment in a young child, which is called disorganized. This is a fourth category. We talked about secure, anxious, avoidant. Then there's what's called disorganized. This typically results when children are neglected or maltreated. And it's important to note that in the general population, only about 5% of kids have this attachment style. But among children who are who experience maltreatment or neglect, or whose families are stressed by other factors such as poverty or parental depression, for example, the incidence of disorganized attachment can be as high as 60 or 80%. And it's just very sad when you see a child have this attachment style, because they are drawn to their primary caregiver, in this case it was the mom, and at the same time they are afraid of that person. And to see this young boy try to reconcile those two feelings at the same time, being onto his mom and being fearful of his mom, was very hard to watch. But I tried to describe it in the book as accurately as I could to give the reader an understanding of what this looks like.
What were some of the behaviors that you observed in terms of Isaiah's reaction to mom?
He did fine when mom came to the visitation room. It was when it was time to leave that he had a difficult period. And there was, his mom was there. There was a social worker who worked with his foster family. And then there was another woman, a social worker, who oversaw the weekly visitation between Isaiah and his mom. So there were three women in the room, two social workers and his mom. And when it came time to say goodbye, he didn't really know who to say goodbye to. He kind of spun around in a circle. He screamed. I asked one of the social workers, like, what's the problem here? And she said, he doesn't know who his mother is. And that's just really sad to see.
That's very sad to see. And it does happen, as you said, for all kinds of reasons. And it's quite sad. And it's quite disturbing, obviously, for the individual. So if you have an adult who has that experience, what's your thought about how that adult is going to do in relationships?
Well, having a disorganized attachment at age two predicts all sorts of problems going forward. Kids who have that are set up to are not going to be able to control themselves emotionally enough to succeed in school, all the way from Head Start and pre-K up to high school. They will often show oppositional behavior, aggression, hostility. Later on, they are likely to become involved with delinquency and even violent criminality. And the notion that they could have stable, solid relationships as adults is pretty unlikely. However, there is good news on this, and I want to make this point because it's an important one. There have been pilot programs developed in over a dozen cities around the country that involve interceding between these kids and their families. They usually involve having specially trained therapists come out to the home weekly, maybe for a year, to work with the kids and their family members. And the results have been great. In some studies, more than 50% of kids with disorganized attachment after a year had a more or less secure attachment. These programs are expensive, as you could imagine.
Sure.
But to my mind, compared to the cost of having these kids grow up and have the problems I just described, it's cheap. And I really think as a society, we should be putting a lot more resources toward supporting and expanding these kind of intervention programs.
There's so much energy, if you will, that we expend on teaching parents sort of the day-to-day stuff that you're right. There's not enough spent on helping the parents to understand how powerful they actually are in their child's life. And for a parent who hasn't grown up with that experience, him or herself, that just gets passed on to the child. Peter Lovingheim, author of The Attachment Effect, exploring the powerful ways our earliest bond shapes our relationships and lives. We will return in just a moment. Peter, I'd like to go back to the subtitle of your book and asking you a question. Again, the subtitle is Exploring the Powerful Ways Our Earliest Bond Shapes Our Relationships and Lives. So you don't say that they are poured in concrete, never to be changed or modified. You say shapes. Tell us about that.
Right, and that's a very good point. Let's start with shape. Attachment theory in a nutshell says that because humans are born helpless, we are hardwired at birth to seek out and attach to a responsible caregiver for protection. Usually this is the mom, but it's not a gender-specific role. It could also be the dad, a grandparent, another adult. But the success or failure of that search, the quality of the bond, whether it's secure and loving or inconsistent or even absent, will actually shape the developing brain and influence that individual in how they relate to other people throughout life. Now, the good news is that none of this is, as you say, poured in concrete. There are ways to change one's attachment style over time. Most people actually go through their whole lives with whatever attachment style they came out of early childhood with, but about 25% seem to change, and they can aim to evolve to something that's called earned secure. So that means that if you came out of early childhood with an insecure attachment style, you can become earned secure later on. How does that happen? Well, sometimes a young person, maybe like in high school age, might be fortunate enough to connect with a mentor or coach, some other adult who's going to provide the kind of security that wasn't there early on. Other people become earned secure by becoming partners with a person who is secure. A long-term romantic relationship or a marriage with a secure person can produce that attachment security. Some people achieve this through a therapy. Others manage to do it through their own experience of parenting, and maybe others through just very deep reflection about their own early childhood and coming to terms with what they experienced, understanding how it affected them, and over time being able to change their orientation toward their own past.
So again, you're not necessarily bound by your early experiences, which I think is so important for people to hear and understand, and so hopeful. If you're an adult, many of the adults who have had difficult childhoods, they really get it. I mean, some will say, no, my childhood was wonderful. But for those who really understand that there were some challenges in their childhood, this is a very hopeful process, if you will, to be aware of and to grow into. And it literally does require growing into, I would suggest.
Yeah, and, there's another aspect to this, which is also positive. Recent studies have shown that people with insecure attachments, while it's not the ideal place to be, nevertheless bring unique and important skills to any kind of, let's say, work team. I can give you an example if you'd like.
Please do.
Yeah, so there was a recent study that looked at how people function on a team. And to do this, researchers brought, about a dozen people into a room. They knew all the people's attachment styles. Those had been measured. They asked them to stare at a computer screen, made up something that they should be looking at on the screen. But the researchers had produced in the computer a sort of fake fire. So the computer at one point started smoking. And what they found was the people with the insecure, anxious attachment were the first to detect the threat from the fire. they were first to detect the smoke. And the people with the avoidant attachment, and remember, those are people who want to be like independent and self-reliant, they were the first to find a safe way out of the room. So from this and similar studies, researchers conclude that in a work team, you actually want some people with anxious attachment because they will be most sensitive to possible threats. They call them sentinels. And you actually want some other people with avoidant attachment because they will be the first to find solutions. And they call them rapid responders. In fact, in another study, they found that the most productive and successful work teams are not those composed only of people with secure attachment, but of people with a mixture of attachment styles, including anxious and avoidant. So this kind of gives a whole new meaning to the notion of diversity in the workplace.
Indeed.
It's diversity of attachment style.
And, you know, what's interesting, you know, certainly in this country, we are so readily able to hear a description or a label, make it a bad thing, and then not want to deal with it ever again. And what you're talking about, again, as you've just said, really, is the value of different styles in different situations.
Right. And I would add also that I think people with an anxious attachment style also tend to be more oriented toward the arts, let's say, because they're a little more sensitive to what they are perceiving around them, and they might have more sort of innate desire to express what they're seeing. So I think you find a lot of people who are, let's say, songwriters, painters, other types of artists, coming from the ranks of those who came out of early childhood with some degree of attachment anxiety.
Now, you shared with us a bit ago that your sense of yourself as having perhaps an anxious attachment style. Can you share with us how you think that developed within you?
Sure. I think in my own, I mean, what I've learned about my own early childhood is that I was the youngest of three kids. And by the time I came along, my mom had developed a mild case of polio. So she really wasn't able to be that consistent caregiver. My dad became my primary attachment figure, but he was busy building a business at the time. So he was not quite there all the time. He hired a housekeeper to live in and help care for me when I was an infant. Sadly, she died suddenly of a heart attack and was replaced by another living person who subsequently was let go. So, you know, I had many advantages in my childhood, but a consistent, reliable caregiver was probably not one of them. And so, like many people, I came out of early childhood with a somewhat anxious attachment style. However, I'm also one of the people who I think managed to become earned secure. And I say that because for my book, in one of the chapters, I took what's called the adult attachment interview, which is considered the gold standard for measuring attachment in adults. It involves a very lengthy prescribed interview by a trained person and then a sort of sophisticated way of scoring it. But I did come out insecure, and the expert who gave me the test felt that that may have resulted from my own experience in parenting three children.
Interesting. So, again, as you give so much valuable information about what attachment is and how it can impact the individual and his and her surroundings, you give so much support and evidence that change can be had, and change can be had in a positive, healthy, and empowering way.
Well, I hope so. And what I wanted to show is that this is something that affects us in, you know, so many walks of life. So knowing about attachment science, knowing our own attachment style can help us be a better friend. It can help us when we're going on a date, for example, to try to some clues as to what the other person's attachment style is, even on a first date. It can help us at work, navigating all the relationships that we face between colleagues, supervisors, customers. And I just think it's an important tool that we can use to better all these relationships in our lives.
You know, you remind me of a word that I hear myself repeating over and over again in my practice, and that is the power of being curious, and how much curiosity requires and allows you to be open and learn new information and gain new perspectives.
Well, I hope so. And one of the things I tried to do in this book, you know, is to make it available to make this information, this knowledge available to everybody, because it's based on some pretty complex science, drawing on fields like social psychology and you know, even anthropology. But I tried to put this all into very accessible terms by telling stories about myself, about other people I met, and illustrating all the ways that we can use attachment, use our knowledge of attachment to get through our lives better. So I saw myself as a translator, really, taking the science, making it available to the average reader.
The process of writing your stories, obviously you met people and you asked people lots of questions so that you could learn and they could learn in relating to you what their own attachment styles were. Was it difficult for you to get people to really kind of open up to you and share their stories?
You know, it wasn't that difficult once we had a chance to talk and I explained that I was writing my own story in the book, for example. So in most cases, people were curious about the topic themselves. It wasn't something they knew about. And most of them were open and willing to let me write about them, tell their stories, and use their stories to help other readers understand attachment in their own lives.
Another piece that you provide by sharing stories is an example of the fact that two people can have different attachment styles and still be connected in the ways that they can tolerate.
Are you thinking there of a particular chapter?
I was thinking about the two best friends.
Yeah.
I think Chris and Celeste.
Oh, this is the couple I set up on a blind date.
Yeah.
Right. No, that was one of my favorite chapters to write, actually. I wanted to talk about attachment and dating, and I realized that just by happenstance, there were two young people, and I happened to know both their attachment styles because they'd both taken this quiz at different times.
Is that the quiz that you have at the back of your book?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
And again, folks, we are talking to, we are hearing from Peter Loewenheim, who is the author of The Attachment Effect, Exploring the Powerful Ways Our Earliest Bond Shapes Our Relationships and Lives. So, Peter, you sort of stuck your foot into the matchmaking waters.
Yeah, you know, there's this great story I got to share. A great story in Jewish tradition where this older man goes to the rabbi and he says, "Rabbi, the Bible tells us that God made, you know, God is so powerful and God made all of the heavens and all the earth in 6 days. But my question, Rabbi, is what's God been doing since?" And the rabbi kind of scratches his head and he says, "God's been trying to make matches. It's that hard." I love that story because for any of us who've tried to fix people up. You know, it's very daunting.
Indeed.
But I did try to do it for this book, and I wrote about the results, because I had one young person who was securely attached, and the other person who was anxiously attached, which isn't a bad match. Those can work out well. Although let me say here that, as one psychology professor I quote in the book says, you know, you can have a good relationship with anybody, but if you can meet somebody who's secure, you're five steps ahead. So that being said, here I had one anxious and one secure.
And Chris was securely attached, and Celeste was anxiously attached, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
So they were both, I think, in their late 20s, professionals, very accomplished, and looking to meet somebody. So they graciously agreed to my scheme and agreed to meet for coffee. So I did some interviews with both of them beforehand and afterwards, talking about how their own attachment styles might color how they would behave on a first day, what they would be looking for. One of the questions that I address in the chapter is this. On a first date, can you tell what the other person's attachment style is? The short answer to that is probably no. You can't tell for sure. But you can make a pretty good guess based on some clues. And one of the clues that I talk about in the book is the degree to which a person self-discloses on a first date. That is, how much they talk about themselves and how much they disclose of a meaningful or emotional nature. So the way this plays out is this. An avoidant person would be likely not to talk about themselves at all, of a personal nature. They would talk about work, sports, real estate, you know, anything but their own real self. An anxious person, on the other hand, and again, that's somebody who's really craving intimacy, will kind of jump the gun on a true intimate relationship and over-disclose on a first date, or just talk too much about themselves. So those are clues. A secure person, on the other hand, would kind of hit what we call the Goldilocks spot. They would, you know, disclose enough, but not too much. And in the process, they would make the other person feel at ease. So that's one thing you can look for on a first date.
And it sounds like there's a lot more you can look for in first and subsequent dates. You've sort of piqued our curiosity a bit. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue the conversation with Peter Lovingham, the author of The Attachment Effect, and what you might be able to look for on a first date, maybe. Don't go away, folks. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you. we're talking about Chris and Celeste. So my guess is that Chris on the first date was pretty even keeled. Talked some about himself, talked some about, and questioned some about Celeste. How did Celeste respond to the first date?
She responded very positively. She enjoyed it. She looked forward to seeing Chris again. So that was a very positive thing.
She talked about being a little anxious prior to the first meeting. Is that correct?
Yes, right. And a little anxiety before a first date is pretty typical for any of us. another interesting aspect to this whole relationship issue and attachment is that attachment has also been shown to be a very new and effective way of couples who are having trouble in a relationship and want to preserve the relationship. There's a whole new field of couples counseling called emotionally focused therapy, sometimes abbreviated as EFT. And this is all based on attachment science. And it has been shown in studies to be far more effective in helping couples maintain their relationship than more traditional forms of counseling that focus on things like communication, for example. So I did a chapter looking at emotionally focused therapy and, again, was very fortunate to find a young couple who were married and who were contemplating divorcing who had gone to a therapist certified in emotionally focused therapy, and they were willing to tell me about their experience in that process. And I'm glad to say that also had a happy ending. The couple is still together. They have a child, and they can't say enough good things about the therapist that they were fortunate enough to work with.
One of the hallmarks, I would suggest, of EFT is the therapist's ability and the client's ability to really take a look at the emotional connection or the lack thereof, rather than what frequently happens in relationships, which is the you did this, you did that, sort of shaming, blaming pieces that will often come up.
Right, and the underlying theory in this kind of couples counseling is that when we are part of a couple, we are providing attachment security to our partner. We are the ones primarily meeting the attachment needs of our partner. And when one or both couples starts not to do that, that's when problems arise. So the therapist will look at what is the attachment style of each of the partners and how are they meeting each other's attachment needs or failing to do that. And once they get that far down, that far below the surface to the true emotional needs that they're each trying to fulfill, they can have, well, as I said, the studies show that they can be more successful.
You also talk about the studies with respect to the impact of attachment styles on voting styles, on politicians. Let's start with voting styles. What did you learn about attachment and voting styles?
Yeah, this was very interesting to me, and I wrote a chapter on attachment and politics. In a nutshell, people who are securely attached tend to be more comfortable with ambiguity, tend to be more tolerant of others, and are not looking for security so much in other areas of their lives. So people with attachment security most often tend to be centrist in their politics. They could be in the center, they could be center left, center right. While people with insecure attachments are more often found on the extreme ends of the spectrum. So, for example, those with attachment anxiety, anxious attachment, might be more often found on the far left, where they might be looking for a strong government to provide security, to kind of fill that hole that they feel inside. And people who are avoidant, who favor self-reliance and see the world in very competitive ways, tend to be found on the far right. They want strong military, they want free economic competition. So that's a very broad picture. And I want to emphasize that this may be true for very large numbers of people, but any individual person doesn't necessarily fit into those categories.
That's absolutely an important piece, I think, to underscore as we go through this conversation. Talk about what you discovered in terms of attachment styles within political leaders.
Yeah, what I found is that, and this is my own hunch based on my research, I believe that attachment avoidance is overrepresented in our political leaders. That is, more leaders tend to be avoidant in their attachment style than other types. I was able to interview current and former members of Congress and as well as a city mayor and one former presidential nominee. And what I found is, with only one exception, they were all avoidant. And I think there's good reason for this. It's because people who are, well let me say this, people who campaign at the state level or nationally, they are away from their families and loved ones a lot while they're on the road. They have to be very self-reliant and independent. They have to be very cautious about who they're willing to trust, particularly in a field rife with betrayal like politics. And I think that having an avoidant attachment style is probably an asset to somebody entering that field and going through the things they have to do to get elected. People with avoidance can still be competent leaders, but researchers suggest that they're probably not likely to be the kind of truly transformative leader that we're often looking for to kind of rise up, you know, help all of us rise up and do our best and come together as a country, which is unfortunate because those are the kind of leaders we probably most often need. And people with avoidant attachment are a little less likely to be able to provide that.
So it's interesting to hear you describe the whys that someone who is perhaps the least likely to provide what so many crave is the most likely to be relatively to extremely successful in the political arena.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And I had no expectation that this is what I would find when I set out to write this chapter. But there are some studies. I mean, the literature does support that conclusion. And I also addressed this in a recent article I wrote for Politico on President Trump's attachment style, as far as I could discern what it might be.
Before we go to that article that you wrote, you did talk about Richard Nixon and what his attachment style might have been. Share that with us.
Right. And let me say, you know, a lot of this is speculation because none of these political leaders have taken the adult attachment interview or even the quiz that I put in my book.
Or if they did, they're not sharing it.
well, actually, except for the one political leader who I did administer the the interview to for my chapter, which was Michael Dukakis, former governor of Massachusetts mm-hmm. and Democratic presidential nominee. He was very gracious in letting me give him that interview. But to get back to President Nixon, researchers who have looked at this subject generally conclude that he probably had an avoidant attachment style, which is evidenced by some elements of his early childhood, which we do know about, as well as behavior in office, sort of a general distrust of even his own staff in many cases, and his sort of rigid self-reliance that was shown in so many ways. My feeling is that if President Nixon and other politicians understood that they have an attachment style like all the rest of us, mm-hmm. and that this attachment style is influencing their behavior, they could maybe avoid a lot of the problems they get into by understanding where, you know, what the motivation is for some of these behaviors, and kind of work around it, and as I say, not get tripped up.
You mentioned a moment ago that you had written an article for Politico, which is online and available, about your thoughts about the attachment style of Donald Trump, and talk about somebody who engenders a great deal of energy. My sense is that people either absolutely adore him, he walks on water, or they absolutely can't stand him. He's the worst thing since the last worst thing. What was your sense as you wrote about and thought about Mr. Trump? What did you come away with as you were doing your work and your research?
Right. Well, first let me say that, people's reactions to the president, as I noted earlier, can be not only because of the president's mm-hmm. behavior, but it can reflect the voter's own attachment style. So I happen to think that that's some of what's causing the polarization, that you have people with anxious attachments and people with avoidant attachments looking at the same presidential behaviors and responding in dramatically different ways, and for reasons that most of the voters don't understand, because they're not aware that their own attachment styles are affecting those responses. But to get to your question about the president, I looked at what we know of his early childhood, and again, it's not that much, but we do know that he was the fourth of five children born of Fred and Mary Trump, and that when his younger sibling was born, his mother had a very difficult labor, and after that birth, she required a number of surgical and other procedures that kept her in the hospital and away from the home, probably for several months. Donald Trump at that point was just over 2 years old, and there's some evidence that that separation from his mother, who was probably his primary caregiver, had the typical effect of interfering with a secure attachment. There was a live-in housekeeper in the family. We don't know what role she played in childcare, but it very well might have been a situation where there was not a consistent, responsive caregiver for at least part of his very early childhood, which could lay the groundwork for an insecure attachment. What type of insecure attachment? I come out on the side believing that it's more avoidant, and I base that on looking at some of the president's behaviors as an adult. These would include sort of a lack of stability in his marriages and romantic relationships, a kind of a more cavalier way of speaking about sexual intimacy than someone who had a secure attachment would probably speak of that. There seems to be a lack of long-term stable friendships with people outside his own family. And again, there's a kind of lack, there's a tendency not to be too trusting of others outside the family. And like I said earlier, these are all attributes that might assist someone in campaigning and being successful as a politician. But in actual governing, they have some drawbacks, as we've seen with other political leaders. So that's, in a nutshell, what my analysis was.
And, you know, as you describe what Mr. Trump experienced and is likely to have experienced in his formative years, it for those who are absolutely on the, you know, he's the worst thing since whatever, perhaps it gives them an opportunity to rethink him with some compassion. I don't know if that would feel useful or not, but perhaps. One of the things that I would like to just point out as we close out our time with you today, Peter, is that, as you've said, in addition to writing about your own attachment styles and learnings, you have also and shown us ways that other people can attach. You talk about attachment in the workplace, as you indicated, attachment in sports, attachment in politics, and attachment in religion. So it really, along with the attachment quiz, of course, and there are many, many resources that you offer, it really is, I would suggest, a wonderful read. And I'm just going to quote Dr. Sue Johnson, who is sort of the mom of EFT, in saying, she says, every reader will find this book about attachment enlightening and above all moving, an easy, absorbing read. And I would certainly echo those sentiments. Peter, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Tell us a website or where folks can go for more information about what you're doing on all the things you've written.
Okay, well, thank you. Let me just thank you for those kind words, and I very much appreciate it. You can learn more about this book and my other books at my own website. It's peterlovenheim.com, and that's spelled LOVENHEIM.com.
Terrific. Thank you again, Peter, so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a mental health, medical health, or other professional. You can always listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from your iTunes or Google Play Store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening today, so do send an email to me at Pamela, that's P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's myndtalk.org. I would love to hear your questions, your comments, whatever you'd like to share when you send that email to Pamela at mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.